Jill Benson is an inspiring and insightful doctor who cares deeply about people and their stories. She's a researcher, a medical educator and a GP, and she's won tons of awards for her work in refugee and Aboriginal health. And I wanted to find out more about this extraordinary person. So I took a recorder to Dr. Benson's GPEX office this month to glean some gems of wisdom and find out what drives her.
I want to be the first port of call for people who have problems. I want to be able to have the ability to help them with those problems without them having to go somewhere else. And I want to have those relationships with people because I think that's one of the most healing things. But I think the idea that there are people, even in Australian society, who can't access healthcare in the same way for a variety of reasons. Sometimes that's financial. Sometimes it's because of the internal stigma, the fear of being judged. And sometimes it is the actual judgment. So I wanted to do that. And I think also has sat there this idea that, and then I discovered the reality, that the problems that people have are quite different from the rest of the Australian people. So I've spent a lot of time with refugees, for instance, who have a variety of very unusual infectious diseases. And that's been great because you can fix a lot of infectious diseases, and that's always terribly satisfying. But also a lot of mental health issues that are very deep and difficult, and a lot of people find too challenging to work with. But I've really enjoyed the glimpse into other people's lives and the way they think, and I've learnt so much. People say, oh, you're so good for doing this. It's like, yeah, maybe, but I've learnt so much from working in this space, and I feel really enriched by the people that I've met working with refugees and Aboriginal people.
And what is it? I mean, obviously two very different groups, but I suppose you could say that both groups have a lot of resilience from histories of trauma. What have you learnt from them in regards to the way that they are so resilient?
So I think the first thing is the idea that you always think that the trauma shouldn't be there. We shouldn't, you know, the Aboriginal people shouldn't have had their children taken away. They shouldn't have had their land taken away. They should be better supported to find a new way of living in the world that they find themselves in. And that we don't do that well. We don't do any of those things well. So, you know, if I could run the world, I would change that. And similarly, the refugees who have been tortured, who've been traumatised, who've had displacement from their families, from their culture, from their work, from their countries, from their language, all of those things. If the world was a better place, those things would not happen. Mm. The other group of people I work with are doctors, and I see doctors who are traumatised. They're traumatised by burnout, by the overwhelming burden of illness that's in the community, by the long work hours, by the bullying that they sometimes meet, by the system failure where there's not enough support for them. So in a better world, none of those problems would exist. And I'd chip away doing my little bit, I hope. But in all of those people, the flip side of that is building up people's resilience so that they can better deal with those inevitable traumas that come their way. And I think the groups of people that I've learnt most from are Aboriginal people and refugees, that they have survived these traumas, they have continued to be generous and loving and caring and smile and make jokes and work and get on with their lives in the face of terrible, terrible pasts that make me weep when I hear their stories.
Well, what are some coping strategies for really severe trauma?
So if I think of some of the refugees I've seen, their stories are terrible. And if I did hear their stories, if they were telling me, sometimes I'd be weeping because their stories are so terrible, and they'd be sitting there calmly telling their story. Sometimes we'd weep together. We'd just weep. And I don't feel ashamed of that. These are terrible stories, and I don't feel bad that as a doctor they touched me emotionally. But I think for me, I then needed to talk to them about how they survived this story. And to me, that was a joy, a gem, to be present hearing those resilience stories as well. Some of the people from the Horn of Africa, for instance, would talk about this thing that they translated as active forgetting. So they would tell their story and I'd say, so how do you deal with this? And they'd say, we actively forget it. If it comes into our brain, we acknowledge its presence and then we leave it. We don't go back to it. We don't dwell on it. We don't want it to be there. We don't go over and over it. So there are some therapies that we might call active forgetting, but it's this idea of we're in the present now. We've got a future to look forward to. We have, you know, some of the people have said, we are so lucky, we've got the best of both worlds. We can take the good things from our previous culture and the good things from this culture, and we can build a better future for us and our children. And that is so beautiful, because we know a lot of people who take the bad things from their previous culture and the bad things from the present culture, and they don't have a fantastic future. So I say that to people and they say, oh yeah, that's a good idea, let's take the good things. So we go through what the good things are and they collect them. So I've learned from listening to those refugees that that's a good thing to do, making sure we collect the good things. We have to do that consciously. Mm. We have to do it purposefully. And that's something I've learned from Aboriginal people and from refugees, that that's one of the things that they do. They don't go over the bad things. They don't bother with the bad relationships. They find the good things and they nourish those and they remember those and they actively remember them. And that's beautiful. And if we all did that, I think it would be a good thing.
Researcher and GP Dr. Jill Benson is with me on ABC Radio across Australia. And we've spoken about gratitude a lot on this show, because from what I understand, research suggests practicing gratitude on a daily basis can have a huge bearing on your life and how happy you are. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, so researchers like Martin Seligman and Carol Dweck and Barbara Fredrickson talk about this, so I didn't invent that, and the refugees invented it for themselves, but there's been, as you say, quite a bit of research. And they say if you can find three things every day that you're grateful for and why, not, hey, it's a nice day, but it's a nice day and this meant I could walk to work, and hey, walking to work's really good because that's one of my mindful activities. I just concentrate on the walking, I smell the smells, I look at the trees, I hear the birds, I walk through the parklands, and that's a good thing. It's also good for my exercise and that's good for me. So yeah, being a nice day is a great thing. Mm. So that's sort of gratitude. So if we can find three things a day and collect them, so if we're having a really bad day, we can go, oh no, life's terrible, but yesterday wasn't so bad, what was it about yesterday? And we can go back and remember what the three good things were. Some people say that we should do this at night. We should put it beside our bed so when we wake up the next morning, we read those three things we're grateful for the previous day. And it's like, yeah, today's going to be a good day as well. But I think that changes our brain. It changes the chemicals in our brain. It makes our brain feel safer. So we're then more likely to do us things rather than I things. So if we're afraid or depressed or down, we all know we get a bit selfish, we get a bit sort of inward looking. But if we're feeling safe and grateful and joyful, we're more likely to look outward. We're more likely to relate better to people, to listen better to their stories, to be more present in that relationship rather than doing the worrying in the back of our mind thing. And that safety feeling can then, it can be an epidemic of safety and joy, the same as there can be an epidemic of hopelessness, for instance. Mm. So I often say to people when I have a team that hopelessness is the most infectious disease, because if someone's hopeless, the whole team can get hopeless. But similarly, if someone's grateful and joyful, that can be infectious as well, and that can spread to other people.
Yeah. And how about you? How do you look after yourself? I've heard a lot about compassion fatigue. It sounds like that's something that doesn't necessarily happen to you, having, you know, sat and cried with people who you're treating. What are your thoughts on that, and how health professionals can avoid compassion fatigue and look after themselves?
I think the first thing is to notice if it's happening. So I'm not going to pretend I haven't had compassion fatigue, because sometimes I have. I've gotten overwhelmed with the stories. But as you say, you need to find ways of looking after you, after yourself. And sometimes that means having a break. But the first thing is to notice, to know what the small signs in yourself are that you're getting compassion fatigue, and to be able to then act on those, or to talk to someone about it, or to do something. So I think the first thing is, if you're feeling like that, you probably need a break. And a break isn't necessarily not doing medicine, for instance. It's doing something else. Having a balance of different types of work is good, but also a balance of work and non-work. Mm. So some people call that work life, but for someone like me, who absolutely loves their work, it's like, but work is my life. And so I can't say work life. So I say work non-work. So having a balance of work and non-work. So, you know, this morning before I came to work, I have coffee every Wednesday morning with the people in my street who I love. And we have coffee just for half an hour every Wednesday morning, and we catch up. And, you know, that's fantastic. It keeps me connected to people. So that's the third thing, is people. And we know our relationships is the most healing thing for anything. So we tend to take our relationships for granted, but nurturing relationships, making sure they're not just you talking about all your worries, but listening properly and caring properly about each other, and laughing together, enjoying time together, doing nothing together if necessary, but having those relationships is really healing for compassion fatigue, for anxiety, for burnout, for anything. Just the existence of them is incredibly healing.
Yeah, connection is a huge one. Dr. Jill Benson, researcher and GP, is with me. And what do you think about toxic relationships? Is there any way that you can tell a relationship is doing maybe more harm than good? And is there anything that you can do about that?
Well, the first thing about toxic relationships is about the toxic relationships from the past. So we need to be aware of who we're carrying around in our head. Who are the voices in our head that tell us how to behave in the world and what decisions we should make and who we should be relating to and what problems, you know, how we solve problems, that sort of stuff. So are these good people in our lives? So what I call the angels. Or do we have a lot of devil's advocates in our heads who are always saying, you know, you're fat and ugly and stupid, don't you? And I told you that you'd never get anywhere. So, you know, a lot of doctors, for instance, carry around this thing called the imposter syndrome, which is where in their past they've had people telling them they're not good enough, that they're never going to be a good doctor, that they don't know enough, you know, and exams and the media and people like that who imply that doctors should know everything. We compare ourselves to that knowing everything standard, and we don't, so we feel like an imposter. So what is it that we carry around in our head? Are they toxic stories? Are they toxic relationships? Or are they what I call the angels who say, you're doing okay, you look all right, you know, that moment when you walk out of the house and you think, yeah, I look right. The people who say, you're working really hard, you need a break, you're a person as well, you need to make sure that you're caring for yourself as well as your patients, you need to make sure that your relationships are good with other people who aren't just your patients, that you go on holidays that aren't just conferences. So, you know, those sorts of good voices in your head. So that's the past thing. For the toxic relationships in the present, I think for a lot of people, it's not about them as a person. So firstly, you need to work out whether the toxicity from the other person is about your role, about your skin colour, about your sexuality, about your gender, about your religion, something that's nothing to do with you. It's about what you represent for that person. And if it is something about what you represent for that person, leave it. It's not about you. Don't internalise it. Don't let it get inside you. That's that person's problem. If you say, look, I don't think this is me. I think you don't like older white women with blonde hair. And they'll go, yeah, you look just like my mother. It's like, okay, but I'm not your mother. Can we just talk about that? And they'll say, yeah, actually, you're right. Now, they might say that, or they might continue to be angry and horrible to you, and it's just like, no, I don't need to do this. So if somebody can see that they're treating you for what you represent rather than who you are. So I've challenged people, for instance, one of the committees I'm on, when I first joined this committee 15 years ago, it was all tall men in suits on a Saturday who were professors. And I was sort of this young GP, I was young then, who sort of walked up to this group of men and said, hi, I'm the new person on this committee. And one of them looked at me and said, really?
Oh.
How did you get on the committee? And I said to him, can I just feedback to you what you just said to me? I came up to you and said, I'm a colleague, we're working together, and this is what you said. And this man looked at me and he said, you are right. I am so sorry. That was a really inappropriate thing to say. I just put you in a box and that was awful. How can I apologise? At which moment another tall man in a suit came along and said, ah, you here to get coffee? White with two, please. And the first bloke said to me, I wouldn't if I was you. She bites. Now, I'm still on that committee. I never get my own coffee. I walk in, these men, they're not all still on the committee, will come up to me and say, hey, Jill, it's great to see you. Do you want a coffee? It's like, yep, thanks. Sit down. But just feeding back that information to them, they weren't bad people. Mm. They'd put me in that stereotype box, and when I fed it back to them, they instantly realised what they'd done. So I think we need to give people the opportunity to be kind and good.
Researcher and GP Dr. Jill Benson is with me on ABC Radio across Australia. Being a GP, part of your role is a bit of mental health support because people tell their stories. How has a lot of white Anglo-Australians' perspectives and the way that they treat Aboriginal people, perhaps whether it's conscious or unconscious, how do stereotypes affect the community?
I think the biggest thing that I see in Aboriginal health is not talking to the Aboriginal people themselves about what they think would be a good idea. So often we come in and we go, oh, I know what's going to work. It's going to be this. And that's not what people want. Or, you know, the idea of why things are happening and the just dumping and the hopelessness that people just don't go anywhere with because it's hopeless. So, for instance, one of the communities that I've worked in for 15 years, a lot of the children, the babies, you know, the 6 month to 3 year olds, just weren't eating properly. They were too skinny, and because they weren't eating properly, they were getting lots of infections, and you know, it wasn't good for the babies. And people would go, oh, you know, there's terrible mothers. They're just not feeding their children properly. And, you know, I'd try and talk to other white people about it, and they'd say, you know, they just need to stop this and feed the children properly. I went and talked to the young women and said, so I'm really worried about the babies. They're looking a bit skinny, and I'm worried about their immune systems. I didn't say it like that, but, you know, this is what I'm worried about. And the young mum said, yeah, we're worried too because we don't know what to do with babies anymore. You know, the whole stolen generation stuff and the disruption of the community, there's not enough grandmothers and aunties to help us with the kids, and we're not quite sure what to do, and we'd really like some help with this. Do you think you could build us a special place for young mums to go where we can learn about how to look after babies properly? So I said, sure. And so took a long time to get funding. after 10 years. So it's been, it took 10 years. People describe me as a terrier. It's like, no, I'm gonna do this. So 10 years later, I built a special facility for mothers and babies that taught the young mums how to cook, how to wash their babies properly, how to look after the babies, how to just play with the babies on the floor, because they didn't have any role models for this because of the disruption in the community. And now there's no skinny children, zero. So, you know, that was asking the people and sitting on a rock, talking to them, finding out. It took me a while to do that, asking what the problem was, and then just hanging in there and keeping on pushing until we worked it through. But, you know, those dissenting voices when I first started this, they were pretty loud. They were pretty sure of themselves that this was all hopeless and that I was never going to get anywhere and why was I bothering? And it's like, no, this is important. This is our future generation of people. And if we don't help these kids, they're not going to grow up with good hearing, with good brains, with bodies that aren't going to get diabetes, you know, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah. So sometimes we are very quick to make sweeping generalisations and cultural judgment because we think our culture might be superior. Is that the case?
Absolutely. Our culture is not superior. Our culture is another way of looking at the world. And it's one of the sadnesses, I think, of the current world is that we're losing those other cultures. And for every culture and every language and every individual way of looking at religion that we lose, we lose another way of looking at the world, a depth, another layer of depth of what life means, and another way of thinking about existence and relationships and God and the earth and nature and, you know, all of those things. And we can't listen if we don't have the language. You know, I know from my work in Vanuatu. So, you know, I was doing mental health stuff in Vanuatu. So I don't speak local language. The language that everybody speaks is called Bijlama. It's a trade sort of language. But there are hundreds of local mother tongues, and that's where the deep words are, where the spiritual words are, where the emotional words are. And it's not until people talk in that language that they can even try and communicate how they're feeling and the depth of what it means to them in their lives. So we need the languages to be able to express those things, but we're losing languages, we're losing religions, we're losing the way people feel about their relationship with the earth and animals and trees. You know, we're losing that, and I think that makes us lesser people because we're losing different ways of looking at the world. And it's one of the joys of my work that I've met people who I can get a glimpse of those different ways of looking at the world.
What an absolute pleasure to speak to Dr. Jill Benson. She's a researcher, a GP and a medical educator out of Adelaide and has won a lot of awards for her work, an Order of Australia and an AMA SA award.